It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, some key COVID testing supplies meant for Wisconsin are being redirected to other states right now. We'll find out why and what it means for testing here in the state. First, a lot of the food that we eat comes from key agricultural regions around the United States. The fruits, veggies, and nuts we count on year-round, many of them come from one part of California. And a lot of the meat that the U.S. depends on comes from here in the Midwest, with livestock fed by huge corn and soybean farms. But our next guest says those two regions aren't sustainable in the long run unless we make changes to preserve the water and soil that make it all possible. Tom Philpott is the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones. His new book out today is Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I want to visit each of these regions, first of all, and find out what's at stake here. Talk about, first of all, this basin, this valley in California, and how much we around the country depend on it for our produce.
Yeah, so there's this enormous valley in California called the Central Valley, and it goes, it stretches, down the middle of the state. It's like the spine of the state, starting, in Southern California and going all the way up to the Oregon border or near the Oregon border. And it's an amazing place to grow food, and a whole lot of the food that you see in the grocery store pretty much any time of the year comes from that valley, or there are a couple of other valleys in California that are also pretty big, but that's the dominant one. And so it's a place that we've sort of quietly come to rely on without thinking that much about it. And, in researching my book and in my work for Mother Jones, I've just been discovering that there is plenty to be concerned about this area.
We'll dig into that, but let's meet the other main character a little closer to home for us in Wisconsin, the Midwestern meat-producing region, and more importantly for your book in some ways, the place that produces all this soybeans and corn that goes to feed the livestock.
Right. So just as, basically we rely super, super heavily on California for our fruits and vegetables, we probably rely more on the Corn Belt, the states clustered around Iowa, large parts of Wisconsin are included in it. We rely even more heavily on those places for another big pillar of our diets, and that's meat. Because as most people there know, the great bulk of the meat that we find in any supermarket, any fast food chain, almost any restaurant is raised with corn and soybeans, largely grown on the fields of the Midwest.
Now let's check out the worries in each of these places. First of all, this California basin, we get so much of our, produce, our fruits, vegetables, nuts from there. You say there's a big worry about water in particular. What kind of stress is this agricultural system putting on the water in this region we count on?
Yeah, so, it's a really great place to grow food, and it actually has pretty amazing water resources because the entire Central Valley is bordered on the east side by the Sierra Nevada mountain range. And the Sierra Nevada mountain range plays a key role in the weather of the entire West because, what happens is you get these huge storms start off in the South Pacific, and they send literal rivers of water, atmospheric rivers of water to the west, and to the western side of the United States. And what happens is in the summertime, they're largely diverted by high pressure systems north and south. So California doesn't really get very much water at all in the winter. And in the winter, they come straight into California and essentially hit the Sierra Nevada, and all this water falls as snow and creates this incredible resource because that snow then melts in the spring, right when farmers are planting their crops. And you get this, there's been this incredible infrastructure of canals and aqueducts and dams that have been built up over the past century that divert this water onto farms. And so, in some ways, it's a great system and a great place to grow food. But the problem is that farms have gotten so big and so productive and so ravenous for water that their water needs have expanded dramatically beyond what the Sierra Nevada snowpack can satisfy. And they've taken to tapping water from the ground, And they're tapping it at such rates that the ground is literally sinking through large parts of this basin, causing all kinds of infrastructural problems. Bridges and roads and tunnels get snarled up by this subsidence, as it's called, when the land sinks. But the real problem for agriculture is that these aqueducts also get snarled up. And so you end up seeing water wasted, just sort of running off these aqueducts, not getting to farms. And so what do farms do in response? Well, they just, you know, revert to the well even more, suck up more water from the ground that causes more subsidence, that causes more snarl ups of the, you know, the Sierra Nevada infrastructure. And so you're in this loop of just sort of drawing the water down, this sort of race to the bottom of the aquifer.
And that's this water system you write is under stress in good years, if I'm reading you right. This is a place also that historically, we've seen in recent years, can have droughts. Talk about what happens when the system, already stretched to capacity in some ways, experiences a drought.
So what happens when you get a drought is that you get a veritable drilling frenzy. You get farmers who don't have wells because they're used to getting good water dropping new ones. You're getting farmers who already have wells and are already using them, dropping deeper ones. And so you just get this big sort of frenzy of well drilling. And one of the things that happens is that a lot of people who live in the Central Valley, most people who live in the Central Valley aren't very high income, especially in the rural parts of it. There's a lot of, farm workers working at poverty wages, not making really a living wage. And they, two things happen to their water. One, their water can literally be cut off. If you're, in a rural area and you rely on a well, those wells routinely go dry during California droughts. The other thing that happens is that as the aquifer gets lower and lower, the naturally occurring elements in the water, the naturally occurring chemicals like arsenic concentrate, and also salts concentrate, and you get water that's undrinkable, and sometimes water that's too salty to grow crops in. But if you're a farm worker living in the area and you're making $18,000 a year, it's not very fun to have to pay thousands of dollars a year to buy drinking water, to buy bottled water for your family. And so that's one of the consequences of it.
We're talking to Tom Philpott about his new book out today. It's called Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. So it's water in this Central Valley in California that you're mainly worried about. Here in the Midwest, it's the soil. Talk about the threats you see there.
Yeah, so the problem that I see in the Midwest is that you've got this incredible resource of this loamy topsoil. You know, I should have said in California, it's one of the few Mediterranean climates in the world, and that's one of the reasons why it's such a great place to grow food. And the Midwest has this very rare and large stash of prairie-derived topsoils. It's one of the four or five places in the world that has a stash like that. Feet and feet of loamy topsoil that grew up over millennia of interactions between prairie grasses and wetlands and bison and Native Americans sort of managing the process. And you go from that. And so in a system like that, the ground is covered year round. You've got these, massive prairie grass plants plunging deep into the earth. Storms blow in the spring or late winter and doesn't cause soil erosion in any significant way. And when you go from there to narrowing down to two crops, corn and soybeans, that are both harvested in the fall and planted in the spring, don't really establish until, like, let's say May or June, you've got all these months of bare ground. And when you're increasingly dire and, huge spring storms blow in, it just pounds that bare soil that's, very often not covered, for the most part, cover crops and things like that aren't used very much. And what you see is soil erosion at levels that are just staggering.
And you see, tying both of these places together, California and the Midwest, a lot of political influence in the hands of the people making money off of it, which in many cases isn't the actual farmer. It's the companies that sell them their supplies and that move along their produce. Talk about the political side of this.
Yeah, so I have a big chapter in there in the book, just sort of laying out how the real beneficiaries of the system aren't the farmers really so much, because when you're growing commodities like corn and soybeans, you're sort of living under hyper competition. You're competing with your neighbors who are growing the same crop. You're competing with farmers in Brazil, where they're plowing up the savanna at, you know, staggering rates to put in what, corn and soybeans. And oftentimes the soybeans are higher quality in terms of protein and things like that than US soybeans. You're competing against farmers in Ukraine that are doing the same thing with one of these other, you know, rare stores of topsoil, prairie-derived topsoils. Same with Argentina. They have got this great Pampas region that's similar to the Midwest. They're very rapidly putting in corn and soybeans. So you've got this hyper-global competition, but really there's this interlocking set of companies that that basically dominate this trade globally. So you've got your seed/pesticide companies that sell the sort of, you know, technology protected, patent protected seeds that farmers pay a technology fee on. They're often paired with their own pesticides. Three or four companies, you know, basically in the US, two companies dominate the trade in corn and soybean seeds. You've got, you know, a small handful of meat companies that have been in the headlines recently for horrible conditions in their meatpacking plants. But they're the ones that buy all these corn and soybeans and turn them into meat. They're a very tightly consolidated group of companies. The tractor companies, there's just two of them really that dominate the trade in tractors and combines. Fertilizer is also very consolidated. Grain trading is basically Cargill and Bunge and Archer Daniels Midland. And so what you get is very little competition among these suppliers and hyper competition by the farmers. And so these, you know, the suppliers and buyers, and these companies capture the profits from this trade. And being sort of smart, you know, companies, they invest a portion of that profit in lobbying in Washington, in campaign finance. And, you know, sort of the farm bill and other farm policies basically enshrine this corn and soybean duopoly, and they're the ones benefiting from it. And they will fight, you know, really hard in Washington to maintain that system. That, you know, I should say, you know, why do farmers keep planting if they're not getting profits from it? Well, the answer is these government programs, crop subsidies, sort of keep them afloat. And so we, the public, are keeping farmers afloat while these companies make off with all the profits.
Tom Philpott is with us, author of the new book, Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. You can join in with your thoughts, questions, maybe experiences at 800-642-1234. As a consumer, do you seek out local produce, dairy products, meats? Are you worried about a big, large-scale agriculture in this country? If you work in agriculture yourself, what do things look like from your point of view and what you hear the guest saying? Do you do things, if you farm at any scale, to try to protect the soil, the quality of your soil, the erosion of your soil? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Tom Philpott about his new book out today. It's called Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. Tom profiles farmers and activists who are trying to save American farming in the face of risks to the soil and water that make it all possible. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or thoughts about how we produce and distribute our food in the United States? Do you try to buy local when you can? Do you work in agriculture yourself at any part of the process? What do you think about our guest has to say about his concerns, especially here in the Midwest, about preserving our soil? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tom, we've laid out the outlines of the problem. You go into a lot more detail in the book, of course, but I want to spend a little time on what you see in terms of solutions. And you write that it's more than just, you know, consumer-driven, consumers trying to solve the problem by their choices.
Yeah, I think that's right, because I think in this country we have had a pretty amazing movement over the past 20 years, let's say, of people asking questions about where their food comes from, seeking out local farmers. You know, we've seen a boom in farmers markets that has leveled off, but at a level that would not have been imaginable 20 years ago. We've seen, you know, CSAs, community supported agriculture programs on a similar trajectory. We've seen big, you know, food companies, supermarket companies buying local food or trying to buy local food, buying organic. But, you know, we've gotten to this great place, and I have seen a leveling off in things like farmers markets. And yet all of the problems that I write about in the book have intensified over the same period. California's in worse, the Central Valley's in worse shape, the Midwest is in worse shape, and climate change is actually accelerating both the problems that we just talked about, bigger storms, bigger droughts, et cetera, because of climate change. And so what I think that we have to do now is figure out how, as a society, we can wrest control of farm policy, you know, both in state houses, places like Sacramento and California, and, you know, state houses in the Midwest, and also in DC, how we can wrest it away from these vested interests that are benefiting from the situation. And, you know, like I said, they invest a lot of their money in it. And I guess the things that I have seen that have given me most hope are things like the Green New Deal proposal that was floated a couple of years ago by Senator Markey and Representative Ocasio-Cortez out of New York. And, you know, it was sort of a vague policy proposal with some goals. And the idea was that, you know, social movements, people involved in climate activism, people involved in food activism would come together and come up with the policies necessary to meet these goals. And I think, you know, the sort of Green New Deal idea lost a lot of momentum, I think, when the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren campaigns ended up not being successful. They were proponents of it. They were pushing it, and they lost to a candidate, Joe Biden, who's not that into it. But, you know, I am getting some a strange bit of hope from this awful pandemic situation that we're in. There's nothing good about it. It's killing people. It's creating a giant economic crisis. But I do think that heading out of this crisis, we're going to need a big jobs program and a big change in the economy to sort of get people working again. And I think that the Green New Deal is sort of one of these ideas that are lying around. I think it was Milton Friedman who said, in a crisis, you look to the ideas that are lying around. And, you know, here's this idea lying around for, if you look at Bernie Sanders' proposal, there's a lot of detail in there about, you know, diversifying agriculture in the Midwest, you know, paying farmers to store carbon in soil. And in California, you know, basically California, I didn't really mention the California crisis that much, but there was a lot of, you know, sort of money and proposals in there for building out local and regional fruit and vegetable farming that could just take pressure off of California. So as California adjusts to its new water reality, which it has to do, we're not left wanting fruits and vegetables because we'll have more local fruits and vegetables produced. And I think that, you know, since we know that we're in an economic crisis and we know we need a big economic plan to move out of it, I think something like the Green New Deal could be something that people rally around as our society figures out how to get out of this economic crisis.
Absent a nationwide effort like that, we've on this show talked to farmers in the state trying to protect their watersheds in part by using, you know, cover crops or other techniques. Do you see maybe small and mid-sized agriculture taking the lead and at least piloting some things that could help solve some of these problems?
Oh, yeah, I have a lot. I have some of those anecdotes in the book, and that is exactly what's happening. You've got farmers who are looking really hard for a different way and experimenting with new models that work at least as well as a big commodity system economically for them, but that also clean up water. And I think that, you know, you guys in Wisconsin have a lot of problems with watersheds getting polluted by large dairy CAFOs, and you've got a problem of low dairy prices pushing smaller mid-sized dairy farmers out of business and, you know, giving more power to the large operators. And I think we're going to see a lot of pushback on a local level to some of these problems. One of the things I try to make clear in the book is that industrial agriculture's sort of costs are felt most keenly and most immediately by the people in the areas where it happens. And I think that we already see social movements in places like the Central Valley in California, in places like Iowa, that are pushing back really hard against this these catastrophes. And that too gives me a lot of hope.
Just in our last couple of minutes, if we stick with our status quo, plus climate change, of course, spend a couple of minutes telling us what's at stake, what could be lost if we stay on this course.
I mean, if we stay on the course, we're going to see harsher and harsher storms thundering through the Midwest in the spring and summer. We're going to see more and more soil going on the move. We're ultimately going to see, we're going to get to a point where just adding more fertilizer doesn't boost yields up, and there's no seeds that are going to bail us out of it. There's no, like, you know, drought tolerant GMO seed that is going to deal with, you know, less and less water, or a seed that will help a corn plant yield high with poor soil. I mean, it's way too complicated. It just doesn't exist. And we're going to see, you know, things like the bounty in the produce aisle that we're used to. Any time of year, just all of this incredible stuff for not very much money, relatively speaking, we'll see a change in that. That is inevitable. And the sort of way that Americans for a couple of generations, if you have a decent amount of money, you don't have to think about that much about your food system. That's going to change. We're going to be in a situation where if we don't get ahead of this, we are going to have crises imposed on us. And I think the COVID-19 situation is showing us that we need to work on our crisis response as a society. We need to figure out better ways to deal with crisis. Because if we don't change course with our food system, we are going to see many crises coming down the pike.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Great conversation.
Tom Philpott is the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones. We've been talking about his new book out today. It's called Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. Coming up, Wisconsin COVID-19 testing sites are seeing lighter supply shipments recently. We'll find out why some gear meant for Wisconsin is being redirected to other states. And today is primary election day in Wisconsin, when voters determine which candidates will be on final ballots this November, including in races for the U.S. House of Representatives and the state legislature. Follow results tonight starting at 8 at WPR.org/politics. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Enbridge pipeline segment in northern Wisconsin may be rerouted through private land. We'll get the latest on the proposal from a WPR reporter. First, you've likely grown used to hearing the daily numbers of how many new positive COVID cases are in the state and around the nation. But a big factor in those statistics is the number of tests available. Wisconsin healthcare systems are seeing some changes in the testing supplies they're receiving recently, with some key ingredients being rerouted to other states. Adam Rogan is a reporter for the Racine Journal-Times. Adam, welcome back to Central Time.
Howdy.
What kind of things are we seeing shortages of in Wisconsin, or at least some supplies that were expected to come to the state going elsewhere?
So right now, a lot of it is still kind of up in the air. We still are able to sell of community testing here, but a number of supplies specifically for testing for COVID-19, mainly the reagents needed to run those tests and collect those tests, have been scaled back. And so what that's forced is that a couple of health systems have had to cut back on the testing they're doing. For example, Aurora has had to shut down a couple of its community testing sites and isn't testing all of its surgery patients. Ascension Health, again, another one of the biggest ones of the state. They haven't had to cut back yet, but they have had a reduction in the supplies coming in. And then here in Racine, we had a couple community testing days set up. One of them was canceled, and another one might in the future get canceled or shortened because the National Guard isn't getting as much as it thought it was going to be getting in terms of testing supplies from suppliers nationwide.
Now, you write that in a way this reflects good news in Wisconsin, in that while we did cross this milestone of 1,000 deaths today, we've done a lot better than other states. Some of these supplies are going to states that are having a hard time right now, correct?
Correct. It's kind of a weird milestone in that we have done well I'm not sure if I can say definitively we've done well, but we haven't
less
had
badly,
these ma-
yeah.
Yes, we haven't had these massive, massive breakouts like we saw in Italy months ago, and especially like in New York at the beginning of the pandemic, and in a couple states, particularly in the South, where they have we're getting closer to overwhelming medical facilities. Whereas in Wisconsin, we've been able to since we've been able to avoid these massive, massive breakouts, we've been able to basically the decisions made by the powers that be have been able to said, okay, Wisconsin can handle a little bit less testing, even if, you know, health officials aren't super happy about that.
Are these federal decisions ultimately saying let's divert some supplies from a state like Wisconsin to some of these hotspots?
That is what I'm hearing from the health leaders here, whether heard them from county leaders and then, like I said, from Aurora and from Ascension. It's basically the federal government said, hey, telling suppliers, hey, you should send, instead of sending to Wisconsin, you're actually sending this shipment to Florida or to New York or to Missouri or whatever it would happen to be. And then it's not basically what kind of what I've learned and what reporters have learned is all kind of just come through the pipeline, especially since it hasn't created huge problems in Wisconsin yet. The real question is in a couple weeks if there's a change in rates and transmission, hopefully not for the worst, but if it's for the worst, we're going to start seeing, hey, we need more tests. We're not going to have the stock for it. At the moment, we've just, like I said, in Racine, we had one day cancel and a couple community sites shut down. But in terms of the grand scheme of things, it's still not clear how much of a detrimental effect this will or won't have, at least in terms of our testing.
We're talking to Adam Rogan, reporter for the Racine Journal-Times, about a piece he wrote on COVID-19 testing here in Wisconsin, some key supplies, as we hear, being rerouted to other states, states experiencing more significant outbreaks right now. Pulling back to the big picture a little bit, Adam, can you talk about the progress that's been made in the state since the early days when, even if you blatantly had COVID-19, it was pretty much impossible to get a test for it in Wisconsin?
I remember I spoke with somebody, it was either late March or early April, who had driven to the local hospital, had been told by, I can't remember if it was her doctor or one of the people who worked for that health system on the phone, said, go to the hospital, they can test you if you're sick. And she went and she sat in the parking lot. She told one of the people there who came up to him covered in PPE, what her symptoms were. They went back inside and came out and said, I can't test you, I'm sorry. Because they just did not have the supplies. And right now we have very few reports of that. The biggest problem we have, it sounds like, is just sometimes people be the National Guard or a health system or a health department being slow in getting tests back. But we haven't so much had the issues of not having enough tests or systems not being able to give those tests. And right now it sounds like we might be heading into that again. It's still not clear. And also there's a million different factors. If nothing else, there's 50 different states dealing with this simultaneously. But that's the big question right now, is that are we going to start running into that again?
What did you hear from the health systems you talked to and others about the importance of having pretty much as much access to testing and speedy response testing as we can get in the state?
Well, I think that's it's been hoped on to the point where I can probably quote from memory what a couple like DHS heads and lookouts have said. But they said, if we don't have good testing, we don't know how bad the pandemic is at any one moment or any one place. And so if we need to divide more resources, or if there's a breakout in a small town, we can tell people there, hey, it's really bad. It is extremely important for you guys to socially distance right now. And without testing, we don't know that until people start dying. I shouldn't say we, the doctors who are much smarter and went to college a lot longer than I did, then they know that. And without testing, it's really, really tough to know what's going on. And that's why testing is so important. And if we run out of that, we run out of the ability to respond to a pandemic.
As you talk to people who are doing this testing and the systems that manage it, as you say, you know, a couple little changes here, a couple small events may be canceled. Are they worried? Do you get a sense that they're worried if we're not getting these supplies that we're going to have a harder time, say, in 2, 3, 4 weeks?
I think the worry might not be the right word, but wary, I think, certainly is. They're like, all right, well, we're so good for now, but we better have it next month. It's kind of like a paycheck. We're good right now as long as we keep getting paychecks. But if we lose that paycheck, we might be out. And so I think that that's going to be the question, is, are we going to keep getting those paychecks coming in? Are we going to keep getting the supplies? Or are they going to start going to somebody else and we're going to be in trouble?
You also quoted in your piece a deputy administrator of the state health department. What are we hearing from the state when it comes to our testing capacity?
Our testing capacity and that how many labs we have, it's from all accounts, it's fantastic. We've never, at least since April, May-ish, we haven't had any real issues with not having enough labs to run these tests, which we had in the first couple of weeks of the pandemic. Now that there's 80 something labs on board able to do these tests, a couple of them public, most of them private labs, we're in a lot better shape with being able to run these tests. Wisconsin alone has the capacity to test a lot of people, something like 25,000 a day, but we're just not doing enough tests. And without this reagent, if we lose the reagents that are coming in, we start cutting back on the amount of tests we can do, we have a lot of that testing capacity being wasted.
Now, you mentioned some events have already been canceled or dialed back for testing, a National Guard event in Racine. And you're watching, I know, for another scheduled event in a week or so. Is that up in the air now, depending on the supply of this reagent?
At the moment, I hear it's still completely a go. Whether or not, but the last week or 2 weeks ago, when they cut their 3 days down to 2 days of testing, that was announced, I believe, either the day before or on the day of the first day of testing. And when I talked to a couple city leaders last week, they said, yeah, we're still planning for three, but we know that the chance is going to get canceled. It's not really up to them, but the city leaders here really want it to keep happening because they want to keep an understanding of what's going on with scene. Our numbers here are going down, but they're not going down by much. We're hanging on a 7% positive test rate after being up in the 15-16 when we were among the fastest spread in the country. We've gotten better and we want to keep it that way, but with the mayor and others want to make sure we want to know how bad it is here or how not so bad it is here so they know how to respond and know what rules to keep in place, what rules to take away.
We'll keep watching that. And Adam, since we've got you on the line and you're from a part of the state that had another big news story this week, the weather. I know you've been reporting on this derecho thing that went across the southern strip of the state. Can you tell us some what you saw in the area?
I was at work in our office building when the storm hit, and it was sunny day, then clouds, and then it was very dark. Poured is about as hard as I've seen in a while, and then it went away. We've had no injuries in southeast Wisconsin that I'm aware of, although we did have two very, very small tornadoes touchdown. There's been like a lot of trees down, a lot of branches down. I saw a photo of a woman who had a branch went straight through the hood of her car. But there's been some road damage, some closures, but really nothing world changing. Luckily, it wasn't the storm wasn't as bad as it was in Iowa, where over 100,000 people lost power. The big thing here and the warning that went out and the people I saw on the drive home was, if you can't see how deep the water is, don't go into it, because quite a few people lost cars that way and got stuck, and our fire department said to go fish them out. So that was the big lesson there. Was a reminder: if you're not sure if you can get through the water, don't go into it, because you might not be able to get out.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
I appreciate it, man. You stay safe.
You too. That's Adam Rogan, reporter for the Racine Journal-Times. He joined us to, well, touch on the weather in the area yesterday, but mainly to talk about his reporting on Wisconsin COVID-19 testing supplies and why they're being redirected in some cases to other states finding COVID-19 hotspots. You can find his article linked at WPR.org. And by the way, speaking of testing, tomorrow we'll find out about some research into a new COVID-19 test that could hopefully be faster, cheaper, and easier to administer. Coming up today, after the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa sued to shut down an oil pipeline running through their reservation, the company that owns the pipeline has plans for an alternate route. We'll find out what that might look like and the latest steps. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to an expert on media law about the rules around making and broadcasting political ads, even when they're potentially deceptive. Now, the Canadian energy company Enbridge has run a pipeline since 1953 through a portion of land controlled by the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. That pipeline, Line 5, transports millions of gallons of crude oil and natural gas liquid. Enbridge is working to reroute the pipeline after a lawsuit from the Bad River Band. It argued that the company no longer had legal standing to keep it on their land. Enbridge now says it's made progress on a plan to reroute that line. WPR reporter Danielle Kading is based in Superior. She's following the story. Danny, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Before we get into this newest development, Danny, I give a super nutshell version of this pipeline saga. I know you've done this for us many times before. Give us the basics on this suit and where we are coming up to this week.
Yeah, well, like you said, basically, you know, the tribe is arguing that they don't have legal standing to remain or keep their pipeline running through their reservation. Right now, it crosses about a 12-mile stretch of the tribe's reservation, and they have some expired easements crossing that portion of land. They have a majority of the easements for the line, but, you know, Enbridge is moving forward with this because of the Bad River Band filing this lawsuit and asking them to remove it.
And now this new reporting, Danny, that you've shared with us, Enbridge is trying to make progress on this rerouting line. And there's a pretty significant development they announced. What is it?
Yeah, the company withdrew their application with the Public Service Commission on Friday. Basically, they were seeking to condemn private property in order to relocate this pipeline in northern Wisconsin. And in order to do that, they have to file an application with the Public Service Commission, and the regulators have to rule that the project is in the public interest for them to be able to do that. The other option is that they reach agreements with landowners along the route, and they say that they've done that now, that they've come to an agreement with around 300 landowners along the route, and so they won't need to condemn private property.
So this is a pretty big step that they get to skip then, in effect, if they aren't having to ask permission to condemn this land, right?
Yes, it is. And it's different from neighboring states like Michigan and Minnesota. In those states, regulators have to also sign off on the route of pipeline projects. That's not the case here in Wisconsin.
Well, you shared some audio with us. I want to give a listen now to a representative from Enbridge talking about the pipeline. This is their director of Midwest Operations, Trent Wetmore. Here's some of what he had to say about the rerouting of the line.
The band has filed a lawsuit which seeks to force removal of Line 5 off of their reservation. After evaluating multiple routes, we designed and have now acquired an approximate 40-mile route, which will minimize environmental and social impacts while protecting sensitive resources.
And that brings up, Danny, the concerns about the potential environmental impacts and the resource impacts of the line. What have the Bad River Band and other locals been concerned about?
Yeah, they've really disputed that the company's claims that it can build this pipeline without impacting or having minimal impacts on the Bad River watershed and all of the water bodies that would be impacted. You know, this project would impact more than 180 water bodies, as well as 109 acres of wetlands. And it would also impact groundwater supplies to homes in the area, or could potentially impact that. And so really, there's a lot of concern given the company's environmental track record and their history of spills on this pipeline on land, never in water in the Great Lakes, because that's a big concern right now in Michigan. But they've also, you know, in Michigan, they saw one of the nation's largest inland oil spills from Enbridge, a $1.2 billion cleanup of more than 1 million gallons of oil that spilled into the Kalamazoo River. And so people are really scared that something like that could happen in northern Wisconsin and the Bad River watershed.
We're talking to Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, about the ongoing effort to change the path of a pipeline in northern Wisconsin that carries oil and liquid natural gas. I want to give a listen to another person involved in this. This is attorney Rob Lee with Midwest Environmental Advocates, representing some clients opposed to the pipeline. Here's a listen.
But our clients also recognize that Enbridge still has a long way to go to make this reroute a reality. And, you know, also recognizes that there's a great deal of opposition to the continued operation of Line 5, not just here in Wisconsin, but really throughout the Great Lakes region.
Can you talk about wider opposition, not just to this reroute, but to the line in general, Danny?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, that, as you mentioned, that was Rob Lee, and he was representing multiple groups, or Midwest Environmental Advocates was representing multiple groups who sought to intervene in Enbridge's case. Again, a lot of the concerns that we've already touched on, but, you know, one thing that would have allowed them is an opportunity to provide testimony, to provide evidence stating their case. And so that's an opportunity that they will not have through the Public Service Commission, although they will be able to provide public comments and input about their concerns over the environmental impacts through other permits that still need to be obtained for this project, such as waterways and wetland permits from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
What has the company said about the economic need for this oil and natural gas pipeline?
Well, Enbridge has always said that this is a vital energy link to the Midwest. You know, this pipeline runs from Superior, crossing northern Wisconsin, to Sarnia, Ontario. And it provides what they claim is about half of the propane for the state of Michigan, although a draft report from the state of Michigan's task force looking at that issue is kind of questioning that right now. But, you know, basically they say that this is needed to be able to fuel people's homes and that they think that they can do this safely, as they've said before, that they've never had a spill in the Great Lakes, although that it's an aging pipeline, and there's a lot of concern over whether the integrity of that will stand up, especially after they've seen instances recently where some of the supports for the dual pipelines that run under the Straits of Mackinac connecting Lakes Michigan and Huron were affected. So a lot of concerns about the safety of this pipeline.
So this eminent domain issue is one hurdle out of the way for Enbridge and the rerouting of the pipeline. It wasn't the only hurdle, though, Danny. What are some of the things still out there that have to be gone through before this line could change its path?
Yeah, well, Rob, you know, they still have to obtain multiple permits from multiple agencies, including the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. You know, there are legal challenges that are still pending. And, you know, I think part of that is just going to be the process. You know, there's going to be a lot of public involvement and there's going to be public hearings and meetings. And so that's all going to take time. And, you know, they're hoping to begin construction on this project within the next year, pending receipt of those permit approvals. I guess we'll see what happens.
I want to bring things back around to the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. They had that lawsuit about the pipeline going through their land, which led to this rerouting. Are they involved still in questioning the new path?
That is a very good question. I have reached out to the tribe and have not been able to get their thoughts on things moving forward right now. But Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins has said before that the tribe intends to fight to remove Line 5 from the region due to the significance of the watershed. You know, the Bad River watershed drains 1,000 square miles into Lake Superior and into the Kakagan Sloughs, which are considered wetlands of international importance. It's obviously a very important project and could have a lot of impact on not only the tribe, but also people living in northern Wisconsin.
And in our last minute or so, Danny, what is the next step of the many steps that you're going to be watching for on this project?
I think that would be the environmental impact statement process. Right now, they're beginning to draft that. And as that moves forward, they'll have another opportunity for public comment or hold a public hearing on that. And I think it'll be interesting to see the additional details that Enbridge provides related to some of the concerns that have been referenced by environmental groups and landowners and residents about the impacts of this project.
Danny, thanks as always for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. We talked to her today about her reporting on the Enbridge Company's plans to reroute a nearly 60-year-old pipeline away from Lake Superior Chippewa land. The new milestone, as we heard, they have agreements with landowners that mean that they don't have to file for eminent domain abilities to condemn land along the path. If you are part of this story in that part of the state, we would love to hear from you. You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Let us know if you are on or near that path. What do you think about the pipeline? If you're happy to have it coming through or you are worried about the possible risks, again, email ideas@WPR.org. By the way, live coverage at WPR.org, updated information, WPR.org/politics about today's primary election results as they come in, WPR.org/politics. Here's a story I stumbled across about a Midwestern weed that isn't really a weed. It can save monarch butterflies, and it helped win World War II. I was talking to my folks the other day about the milkweed in my yard. I'm letting it grow and prosper because of conversations we've had on Central Time about milkweed as a key plant for the monarch butterfly migration. Well, my dad told me about a rumor that went around when he was a kid that people would pay money for milkweed pods. So he and other neighborhood kids in Michigan collected up bags of the pods only to find out there were no buyers. But we did some research and found out he was just 10 years too late. That was in the 1950s. But during World War II, kids were recruited to collect wild milkweed pods, and they were paid a bounty for them. Why? Turns out the milkweed floss in those pods could be used in military flotation devices, life jackets, to replace a product that had been cut off by war with Japan. Michigan was a big place to do that, one, because they had milkweed, and two, there was a milkweed drying center that prepared the floss for use in the military. I did some more poking around, and yes, Wisconsin kids were part of that milkweed effort, too. Back in 2016, Meg Jones at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel wrote about a memorial event where a survivor of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis met a Wisconsin woman who had gathered milkweed in the 1940s, which could have been used in the life jacket that saved his life. So it's got weed in the name, but milkweed deserves some respect. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.